Welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear from Samantha Horton with the latest on the East Chicago demolition of the West Calumet housing complex. Sharon Jackson speaks with Money Smart Week Northwest Indiana Chairperson Diane Renome about Financial Literacy Month. And Chris Nolte speaks with the Democratic District 1 Senate candidates Frank Mervan and Mark Kurowski about the upcoming primary election. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Demolition began Monday afternoon on East Chicago's West Calumet housing complex. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, the USS Lead Superfund site still leaves former residents concerned for their future.
An excavator slowly tore down a duplex at the corner of Magnolia and Astor as water was sprayed onto the building to prevent contamination from spreading. John Blosky owns the engineering company doing the work and says his group will be providing updates to residents throughout the demolition process.
This is an environmental issue. It's important that people have trust in us that we're going to do our job correctly, too.
Former West Calumet resident Akeisha Daniels says she still has trouble trusting everything is being done in the safest manner for those still living close to the housing complex.
To me, I don't think anything they would do would be satisfying to me on either end. But I know that it has to be done, and you know, we just have to believe that they're doing everything possible to keep us all safe.
The demolition comes after a couple of weeks in delays, but is slated to be complete in August. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Lawmakers worked on a controversial school financial management bill this year, but it died in the last minutes of the regular session. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports, the mayor of Gary says lawmakers should avoid more community-specific mandates during the special session.
Lawmakers worked on a controversial school financial management bill this year, but it died in the final minutes of the regular legislative session. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports, the mayor of Gary says lawmakers should avoid more community-specific mandates during the special session.
Talk around House Bill 1315 was dominated by parts of the bill focusing on Muncie and Gary schools, and some people have expressed concern about the possibility of the bill's revival during a special session later this year. But Gary's mayor, Karen Freeman Wilson, says provisions limiting the power of school officials in her community are bad for government.
Fiscal difficulty shouldn't mean that you're throwing those checks and balances out of the window.
She says at this point, there's no further action lawmakers should take around Gary schools. The General Assembly is expected to convene for a special session in May. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana's Transportation Authority will provide at least $125 million in matching grants to local governments that undertake railroad safety projects. The Department of Transportation program will require local agencies to contribute 20% of the money for land acquisition and construction. The state would take care of the rest. Governor Eric Holcomb was in Chesterton Monday to unveil new details for the local tracks overpass. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barb Argiano has more.
The new program stems from the Next Level Roads Plan. It's aimed at both decreasing traffic congestion and increasing safety around railroads. Governor Holcomb says state funds are available for local communities that apply for the grant.
So we're encouraging every mayor, every commissioner, every councilman throughout the state to pursue this program. Don't wait. Pursue it right now.
Indiana Department of Transportation Commissioner Joe McGinnis says proposals will vary depending on a community's needs. The state will accept proposals from May until the end of August. Grant winners will be announced starting in late summer.
The plan is part of Governor Holcomb's agenda to upgrade the state's infrastructure. Holcomb signed a bill last year authorizing funding for the program, which was part of an infrastructure improvement plan approved by the legislature that hiked taxes and fees. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. U.S. Steel will pay a $600,000 civil penalty
and $630,000 to reimburse various federal agencies for costs and damages after one of its plants discharged wastewater containing a potentially carcinogenic chemical into a tributary of Lake Michigan, federal and state officials said Monday. The U.S. Justice Department said those terms are contained in a consent decree filed Monday in federal court in which U.S. Steel promised to take steps to improve its wastewater processing monitoring system to resolve alleged violations of the Clean Water Act and Indiana law. The April 2017 spill at a U.S. Steel manufacturing and finishing plant into the burned waterway near Portage, Indiana, contained hexavalent chromium, a toxic heavy metal that the EPA has said might be carcinogenic if ingested. The Justice Department said the plant experienced a rupture in an expansion joint in waterway pipes, discharging untreated wastewater into the tributary. Today's settlement with U.S. Steel appropriately penalizes the company for last year's wastewater spill, recoups the government's response costs and other losses, and requires significant actions by the company to prevent toxic spills like this from occurring again, Jeffrey H. Wood, the acting assistant attorney general. As part of the agreement, U.S. Steel will reimburse the EPA $350,000 for its response costs and the National Park Service more than $250,000 for its response costs and damages resulting from the week-long beach closures along the Indiana Dunes National Lake Shore, the Justice Department said. U.S. Steel said in a statement, the steps it's taking include installing a new wastewater piping system and completing repairs to a contaminated trench, implementing new spill notification procedures. The company said the consent decree also resolves violations from another wastewater discharge last October containing a less toxic form of chromium. The settlement is subject to a 30-day public comment period and final approval by the court. The EPA has said hexavalent chromium is used in a variety of industrial processes, including steelmaking and corrosion prevention, and as a pigment in dyes, paints, and inks. It's also found in ash from coal-fired power plants. A case involving the chemical was made famous by the 2000 film Erin Brockovich, which was based on a utility's disposable of water laced with hexavalent chromium in unlined ponds near Hinckley, California. That disposal method polluted drinking water wells and resulted in a $333 million settlement. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. There are nearly 20 active public school dual language programs in Indiana, but you don't have to tell that to a class of kindergarten students at Westview Elementary in Muncie. They are the first Muncie Community School students to be educated in the Spanish-English dual program. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Tony Sandberg report, they'll be able to continue in the program if this year goes well.
Meet Mrs. Morales' kindergarten class. No, they're not learning English as a second language. They're learning Spanish for the first time.
Students spend 80% of their day receiving instruction in Spanish.
Katie Stroh Morales is one of two teachers running Westview's inaugural dual language program. The idea is to get kids exposed to another culture at a young age so they can live more diverse lives in the future. Nyla Salvato is another teacher in the dual language program.
So it's things that they are learning from us and I'm learning from them. So sentences that for them are polite, for me not. We manage like the part of the culture I think that I learn from them and they learn from me.
She came to Muncie from Spain to help teach these classes. Westview principal Eric Ambler says dual language is impacting more than just the students in the program.
I think one of the things that really comes to mind is how this is impacting our entire school's culture. Our music teacher is incorporating Spanish and Latin music into her curriculum just to support and to enhance the program for dual language kindergarten. Our art teacher is also doing the same thing.
The plan is to expand the program year by year as this inaugural class goes through elementary school to eventually include all elementary school students and possibly expand to other schools in the district. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Tony Sandleben in Muncie.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana residents are cleaning up after thunderstorms dumped heavy rain and golf ball-sized hail on parts of the state. Flood warnings were posted along several rivers following Tuesday storms, which were followed Wednesday by sharply colder air and snow flurries. Tuesday storms dropped 2 to 3 inches of rain on a swath of the state's midsection, spawning flooding that washed away part of an eastern Indiana road. Several central and southern Indiana schools were closed Wednesday or on two-hour delays due to local street flooding. Southwestern Indiana's Knox County was pummeled Tuesday by golf ball-sized hail, while Indianapolis was drenched with 3.90 inches of rain. That set a new one-day rainfall record for the month of April. The city's old record was 3.06 inches that fell on April 19, 2011. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A Northwest Indiana county plans to test some of the 240 untested rape kits that are part of a decade-long backlog and make policy changes to prevent another logjam, officials said. The Times reported Lake County officials announced plans Wednesday to test all non-anonymous rape kits performed on or after January 1, 2008. Rape kits performed before that date will be destroyed unless the survivor contacts a local rape crisis center and seeks testing by August 6th. The prosecutor's office didn't immediately say why the older kits will be destroyed. Testing the backlog kits could help the prosecutor's office win more cases, said Lake County Deputy Prosecutor Nadia Wardrop. Law enforcement agencies must now retrieve all completed rape kits within 72 hours of notification. Non-anonymous kits will be tested within 30 days, while anonymous kits will be stored for up to a year before being destroyed. It is a model to be held up and a model that we should all celebrate because we are putting victims first in this country, said Tracy Horth Kruger, CEO of the Indiana Coalition to End Sexual Assault. The county's sexual assault response team will also begin generating quarterly reports to track rape kit intakes. Governor Eric Holcomb ordered the statewide Sexual Assault Response Team Advisory Council to explore the possibility of creating a rape kit tracking and testing database. The changes were sparked by a state survey released in December that found at least 2,500 untested rape kits across Indiana. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The Indiana State Medical Association and the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation announced a program to teach physicians best practices for prescribing opioids. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports it's the first of its kind in the state.
State law now requires prescribers to receive opioid prescription training every 2 years. The Indiana State Medical Association will develop an app to help them do this. President Dr. John McGough says it will allow physicians across the state to access it from anywhere.
So it'll be both app-based as well as podcasts that will allow physicians to learn the best practices for opiate prescribing.
The Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation is funding the development, and President Claire Fidian Green says the initiative is in line with their prevention efforts.
And also help patients connect with non-opioid pain management techniques.
These training methods have been shown to curb prescription drug misuse. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. All of the talk about a possible trade war with China has a lot of Hoosiers worried, especially farmers. China implemented tariffs this week on more than 120 goods from the United States, including pork products, and now it's threatening to add soybeans to the list. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports, Indiana farmers are already feeling some of the impacts.
David Hardin is a third-generation farmer in rural Hendricks County. We're walking along a field on his property when he points to a series of large rectangular buildings.
There's actually four buildings back there, and each one of them has around 1,500 animals.
Inside are hogs, which Hardin primarily sells in the Midwest. Some of them go to a processing facility that exports pork to other countries. As far as Hardin knows, none of his pork goes to China, so it won't be hit with a new 25% tariff. But he says that doesn't matter.
If there's more pork on the market domestically because it's not moving to China, it's going to lower prices for all U.S. producers, whether they play in the export space or not.
Farmers are used to coping with the unknown. Much of their job depends on factors outside of their control, like the weather. Hardin says that's what makes these tariffs difficult to accept. He sees it as something the U.S. government can control. China put tariffs on some U.S. imports to retaliate against President Donald Trump's decision to slap tariffs on imported steel and aluminum.
we've seen such a large drop in pork prices, it equates to about a $3,000 per week drop in our income here on our farm.
Hardin's Farm is one of more than 3,000 family-owned pig farms in Indiana. And they aren't the only ones who could see losses because of tariffs. China is now threatening to put a 25% tariff on more U.S. products, including soybeans. Nearly two-thirds of the soybeans grown in the U.S. go to China. A recent Purdue University study looks at two different scenarios and what they would mean for the U.S. Wally Tyner is an agricultural economics professor at Purdue University and one of the study's authors. During a Skype interview, he says no matter the size of the tariff, applying one to U.S. soybeans would have a significant impact.
For the 10% tariff, our estimate is, and we did a lot of sensitivity on it, but the average estimate was that exports to China would fall 33%. And with 30% tariff, 71%.
The threat of tariffs on U.S. soybeans is coming when farmers are on pace to plant more soybeans than corn for the first time in more than two decades. The USDA says the largest increase will be in Indiana, where farmers will plant more than 6 million acres of soybeans this year. Robert White is the director of national government relations for the Indiana Farm Bureau. He says, frankly, the timing couldn't be worse.
Because we're in a down economy for agriculture, and we're about 50% lower than we were in ag income about 4 years ago.
White says it could be enough to put some people out of business. But it's all up in the air right now. And Hardin says that uncertainty makes it even worse. He says the futures price for pork is already declining all the way into some of his 2019 contracts. And on top of that, Hardin is paying more to replace equipment around the farm.
Many of the products, like replacement gates and flooring that we use on the farm, are made out of steel. Any new tractors obviously have steel as a component. So if the price of any of the products that we buy that are made out of steel go up, we're getting hurt kind of on both ends of the equation.
He's trying to cut back where he can, but it's hard when he has hogs to feed and workers to pay. In Hardin's eyes, there's no winner in this potential trade war. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Money Smart Week is coming up the week of April 21st in conjunction with Financial Literacy Month. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson speaks with Money Smart Week Northwest Indiana Chairperson Diane Renome about the educational campaign to promote financial literacy. Here's the conversation.
This is a campaign, an educational campaign, so to speak. Tell me about Money Smart Week and when it is and what it's being done for.
Money Smart Week this year takes place from April 21st to the 28th. They chose April because April is Financial Literacy Month, and we all can do more with our finances than what we do. It's a Federal Reserve effort that is just that. It's an effort to promote financial literacy and financial capabilities that we all have to do more with our finances.
Is it common for people not to have financial literacy, and what does financial literacy mean?
Financial literacy. I really don't like the words financial literacy because that makes it sound like you're illiterate, but many of us could do much better with our finances than we do. And the way to do that is by learning and paying attention to what's going on in the world and what interest rates are. And a perfect example is if you stay away from these check cashing places, you can increase your income instantly because you are no longer paying the exorbitant interest rates. You don't have to pay for money orders. You can go to any financial institution and get, you know, a checking and a savings account and then hopefully go from there. But these check cashing places just rob you. And this is an effort to get people to move more into the financial stream of the world.
So what kind of topics will it cover? What's going to be taught under the umbrella of Money Smart Week?
Under the umbrella of Money Smart Week, one of the first things that they have partnered with is the FDIC's effort, which is called the Bank On effort. We have now, we started with Bank On Northwest Indiana. Then we have moved into Bank On Northern Indiana Alliance. That is a collaboration of community partners in Elkhart, Lake, Porter, LaPorte, and St. Joseph counties. Northern Indiana Bank On's products and services are available to all individuals looking to improve their financial footprint. It typically, you need $100 to open an account, and if you have a Bank On account, you really only need $25. We have classes to help you figure out different ways to budget and to save money. We've even had insurance classes on how to lower your insurance premiums by doing things such as getting your auto and homeowners insurance from the same company. They offer you a discount at that point. We're working with community organizations such as Catholic Charities, Center for Workforce Innovations, Work One, Citizens Concerned for the Homeless, Housing Opportunities, Junior Achievement, Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District, which is the South Shore Train, Northwest Indiana Community Action, Northwest Indiana Reinvestment Alliance, Purdue Extension, and Real Services out of South Bend. We're working very hard at putting together classes that help people with their finances and show them other ways, as I said before, to either save or decrease their income. Then we try to go in to offer even more classes and help them, and if they want, they could get a one-on-one with anybody. It is a wonderful effort. You hear so many bad stories about financial institutions, and in this one, we actually all play together really well in the same sandbox. Right now, those partners are First Source, Chase Bank, Centier, First Federal Savings, First Financial Bank, First Merchants Bank, First Midwest, First Savings Bank of Hegwisch, First State Bank, Lake City Bank, People's Bank, Purdue Federal Credit Union, Regional Federal Credit Union, and Woodforest National Bank. And we are always looking to partner with more.
What has been done in terms of in educating Northwest Indiana Hoosiers in financial literacy? Have you guys educated a lot of people, made great strides in doing so?
We continue to work at that to do all that we can. And now our latest effort is in the fall. We had a financial summit at Notre Dame. And this year, actually April 24th, we're having the second one. It's going to be at Indiana University, Bloomington. No, not Bloomington. Indiana University, Northwest and Gary. We're going to have people there to speak about all of this. We're going to have Q&A. We're going to have community conversations. Anything we can do to help the public become, we want the public to become more financially independent. If we can get that, we're going to make all of Northern Indiana a better place for all of us to live.
Now, if someone were to ask you, what is financial literacy, what would you tell them?
I would say that financial literacy is just financial education, and it depends. That's an all-encompassing term. Much like if it came to financial education in investing, I would need a ton of classes. I'm pretty good with budgeting and saving. But, you know, different people need different things, and they need different kinds of education in finances. I just recently went to a presentation on Medicare. That's another financial area.
So what do you think the financial literacy campaign, the Money Smart Week campaign, is important?
I think it's really important because we need to stress to everybody that no matter where you're at, it's possible for you to be financially in better shape than where you are right now. You just need education in different areas of the finance to learn how to do that.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate your help. Is there anything else you wanted to add that maybe I haven't asked you about?
There's just one other thing. Also during Money Smart Week at Hammond Development Corporation, the hub of innovation on Holman Avenue, we have Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson coming to talk on Don't Be a Victim, How to Protect Yourself from Identity Theft, which also falls under the financial literacy umbrella, because if someone steals your identity, your finances, are in trouble.
Really appreciate
it. Thank you.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Carl Lissick, host of Green Fleet Radio, which is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities, talking with Ian Hurt, Port Director of the Port of Indiana, Burns Harbor. You can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org as well as on NPR One. Search for WLPR.
Well, thank you for that introduction. And today our guest is Mr. Ian Hurt. He's the Port Director for the Port of Indiana, Burns Harbor. Ian, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Carl. Glad to be here.
So, you know, Ian, most people don't have access to our ports, meaning they haven't really seen what the operations is and what it all entails. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the Port of Indiana and what goes on in the Port of Indiana, Burns Harbor?
So at the Port of Indiana, Burns Harbor, we have approximately 25 companies. They primarily want to have a need to have move cargoes across water. So that's really where a port comes into play is, you know, companies that are looking to take transportation costs out of moving their goods to market. And water is always the cheapest way to move cargo. So if you can move it by water, you're probably going to save some money and make you that much more competitive. So out at the port, we have approximately 25 businesses that handle things like grain. So corn from Northwest Indiana, soybeans. We move a lot of steel products, semi-finished steel products, as well as the raw materials that go into making steel, that go into the mills here along the lake. We have seven different steel processors that will take steel coils and improve them somehow. They will cut them into steel sheets. They will cut them into strips. And eventually they'll go into making things like refrigerators or paint cans or toasters, things that we use every day. A lot of that steel will come in through the port, or the raw materials will come into the port that will end up making those things. We have we handle cargoes like limestone and coal and slag, a wide variety of things. And there's also, you know, the reason that people want to use a port is because there's tremendous cost savings by moving by water. A good example is if you have one tugboat pushing four steel barges, and a steel barge is like a big empty steel box, it can carry about 6,000 tons of cargo. Well, that equals 300 trucks.
I see.
So you get a lot of cost savings. You know, a tugboat has a small crew on it with a couple people, as opposed to 300 trucks that have 300 drivers, that have 300 engines that can go bad, things like that. So if you can move it by water, in addition to being the cheapest way to do it, it's also the most environmentally friendly way to move cargo.
Sure it is. Yeah, absolutely. So how's the port working to reduce its impact on greenhouse gas emissions from the various types of vehicles that you just described?
So what we want to do is we want to get those old diesel engines out of the marketplace. So working with companies like yours, South Shore Clean Cities, you know, if we can get those 1998 forklifts out of service that have the old Tier 1 engines that really emit a lot of emissions into the air, get them replaced with the newer engines, Tier 4, Tier, I think Tier 5s are coming now, they really emit a lot fewer emissions. And so our tenants who are running things like payloaders and forklifts and cranes, again, a lot of it's older equipment, we want to get that old equipment out. For the Port Authority itself, we just have kind of a small fleet of pickup trucks, that type of thing. But again, there we're looking to go to alternative fuel vehicles. So, you know, maybe just having a hybrid pickup truck instead of a diesel-powered pickup truck, something like that.
Sure. So I saw the Port of Indiana, Burns Harbor, recently broke tonnage records for the second consecutive year. Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
So there's really three drivers that will cause tonnage to grow. Okay. So one is you have good companies at the port that their customers like them and they want to do business at the port. So we have a lot of those. We have a lot of good companies that do a good job at a good price. So their customers want their cargo to move through them. The second way that we can do it is with a strong economy. So you're rarely going to set tonnage records when the economy is doing bad. The two just don't go very good together. And the third way that we're able to do that is the port itself is about 600 acres. We currently have about 500 acres under lease to various different companies, different tenants. So we have 100 acres that's available to bring in more companies and bring in more tenants. So we want to find companies that are going to move cargoes across the water, have them come in, and then, you know, that'll drive up tonnage with they have to bring in 100,000 tons a year of cargo to come into the new facility.
Well, I know you have a major expansion plan at your facility. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, we received $9.85 million from the federal government in a Fastlane grant. So when you hear people talking about the infrastructure, you know, they want to drive infrastructure projects, this is one of them that's going to happen. the port and our tenants, we're also going to contribute about $9.85 million, so a little under $20 million total.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
It's going to go into five projects. Two of those are going to be rail yards that will increase the capacity of rail that we handle at the port, bring it up another 185 rail cars. And what that does is it allows our tenants to stretch their footprint into the hinterland for delivering those cargoes further out. So rail is much more cheaper way to move cargo than by truck.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get more rail in, that kind of expands your footprint and allows you to move your cargoes farther and still be cost competitive. The other three projects, one of them is we're going to improve about 1,200 foot of dock, give us two more berths for loading and unloading barges and ships.
Mm-hmm.
And then another one is going to be improving our bulk unloading area. So when you have raw materials that come in like coal or limestone, things that move big piles of cargo, what we want to do there is go with more conveyors. It moves things quicker and easier. Sure. And more direct. You don't have as many equipment breakdowns. And the last project is going to be a truck marshaling yard where we're going to have trucks parking in one spot as opposed to kind of all over the place.
Sounds exciting. Sounds like we're going to create some more jobs here in Northwest Indiana also.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, these five projects are going to take a lot of construction jobs to get them all built. And then with these infrastructure improvements, then we'll hopefully be able to attract more tenants, fill up that 100 acres I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
get those more companies in and get longer lasting full-time jobs that are usually jobs at ports are good paying jobs. So mm-hmm. that's a good thing to have.
Well, I know in these plans that you're talking about, are there like sustainable options? Again, we're trying to talk about green things and the different things to reduce emissions, reduce fuel and things like that. So in our expansion plans here that you're talking about, can you talk just a little bit about some of the sustainable options that maybe you're looking at?
So two of the projects we definitely think are going to be very sustainable. The one is the truck marshaling mm-hmm. yard. What we're looking to do there is right now we have these 25 businesses, and they all have trucks loading and unloading their facility. So you'll get a line of trucks, 5, 6, 7, 10 trucks in line. And as one truck gets loaded or unloaded, all the remaining trucks in line all inch forward 500 feet or 50 feet. And then they keep their engines idling the whole time they're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's cold outside. It's hot outside. They want to be in the comfort of their climate control cab. What we want to do is build this marshaling yard, get all the trucks to park in one spot, and then we'll build a trucker's lounge so that they'll get out of their trucks, they'll go into the lounge, they'll have the comfort of an air-conditioned room
mm-hmm.
or a heated room, they'll have a television, they'll have a place to sit down, stretch their legs, and then they'll be able to communicate directly with the companies inside the port. We'll then notify them that, okay, it's your turn now, come get loaded. Then they'll go to their truck, they'll go in, they'll get loaded or unloaded, and then they'll move on. So instead of idling for an hour or two waiting in line, they'll be parked, their engine will be turned off. And, we handle about 1,000 trucks a day through the port. So if we can get 10% or 20% or 30% to mm-hmm. use that's that many trucks that are going to be idling that much less. The other project that should have some sustainability will be the bulk unloading and loading facility mm-hmm. that we're going to be building, that dock. By utilizing conveyor systems instead of payloaders, again, the payloaders are older diesel engines burning a lot of fuel. These conveyor systems may be electric, or at the very least, they're going to burn a lot less fuel than these diesel engine payloaders. Because the loader unload a ship, you're going to be running 5, 6 payloaders at a time. Here, you're just going to turn on one conveyor system.
Sounds very exciting. And if people like to learn more about what's going on at the port, can you give them your web address?
Sure. It's www.portsofindiana.com, ports with an S, Ports of Indiana. And we also have a quarterly newsletter. There'll be a link on the website so you can get the most recent information by clicking on that. And you can always give our office a call. We're here to serve the community. We mm-hmm. want to be out there in the community and letting people know what's going on at the port.
Well, Ian, congratulations, and we look forward to having you on future shows to give us an update on what's going on at our great port here. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thanks again to Ian Hurt, Port Director for the Port of Indiana, Burns Harbor. Green Fleet Radio airs 3 times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks again for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. John Kane, host of Eye on the Arts, talks with Gloria Tui of the Indiana Ballet Theater. You can hear Eye on the Arts every Monday here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts of Eye on the Arts are available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org as well as on NPR One. Search for WLPR.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Gloria Tui, founder and artistic director and everything else of Indiana Ballet Theater. Gloria, welcome back.
Thank you.
So you're preparing for your spring ballet.
We sure are.
And it's Swan Lake.
It is.
And we're going to get into the depths of the psychology of Swan Lake right now. So Did I know, you wrote this question for me, did you know Odette, the lead swan, became a queen at the age of 9 when her parents died? I never knew that.
I know. Can you imagine?
At the age of nine years old? Now, did she have a regent who kind of was behind the throne, who coerced her and manipulated her and made her take ballet lessons? And that's how she became the star of a ballet by Tchaikovsky. Sorry.
Something like that.
So how did she turn into a swan?
Well, there was this very evil Van Rosbart. He was a sorcerer.
Uh-huh.
And he changed her into a swan because he had a daughter himself who he wanted to rule the kingdom.
Oh, so he put his own daughter in her place.
That's right. That's
he
what
put
he
her
wanted
out
to
on
do.
The pond.
Yes. So that's Odile. That's the other character. The other lead.
Odile is the other daughter. She's the evil daughter.
Yeah, she's the black one.
And the black swan.
No, Odette's the white swan, yeah.
Oh, they were real simplistic in that, weren't they? That's not very PC these days. I think we should have, other colors. Red and green, maybe. Odile then became the princess? Is that what happened?
The evil magic, she was allowed to be a female during the midnight hours, and then during the day, she was a swan. And so when they went to the ball for the prince, who had to choose a wife, the Rothbart took his daughter Odile.
Right.
And the prince mistaken her for Odette and said he would marry her.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that was the true love curse, and that's what broke the spell. So now Odette had to live as a swan forever. But the prince decided to fly away with her and become a swan with her.
Yeah.
So lived happily ever after.
That's nice. I like that story. Except, really, it is. It's sexist because only the prince's true love is going to save the day. It's colorist in that it's white and black. And at least we could have other colors, pastels for Easter season.
I can't change the tradition, John.
Okay.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. It is.
It's very sparkly and lots of diamonds. And
I love sparkles. And I love Tchaikovsky music. It's just the most beautiful. So you're doing this, we should say, soon.
Yes. Well, also, people might like to know, before I give you those dates, is that we have a special character in our mist scene, of King and Queen of the Mist, that are lookalikes for Barbie, so that it's made to be for all of the family any age. So they will have fun.
Okay. So you've added those little elements.
We have added those.
Clever.
Yes.
That's very clever. Okay, now, can we hear the dates?
Yes, it's April the 13th and 14th at Merivale High School.
Mm-hmm.
The 13th is 8 o'clock. The 14th is 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's also with a T in Michigan City on the 15th at the Uptown Theater.
Wonderful. So you're getting it out there.
Yes.
You're branching. How's the Art Center coming along, the Classical Arts Center? I'm sorry, I have to ask.
I knew you would ask.
Of course.
It's going to open in the fall, John.
You're always telling me this. Okay.
No, this is it. This is the year.
Okay.
The board has decided. This is it.
All right. So you have your funding in place, and we're going to see all kinds of construction going on over the summer months.
Soon, yes.
Great. Well, that's exciting. So Classical Arts Center yet to come at the corner of just north of 93rd and Taft.
Correct.
Yeah, in Crown Point / Merivale, that area. All right, Gloria. Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Great. I'm really happy to know all about Odette and Odile now. Thank you for being here. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Regionally speaking host Chris Nolte recently sat down for a conversation with the two Democratic Party candidates for the Indiana Senate District 1 seat. Veteran incumbent State Senator Frank Mervan and his challenger, Father Mark Kurowski, came into the studio to talk about the reasons for running or seeking re-election and about the issues that affect Northwest Indiana residents. The conversation became spirited at the end, as you can hear for yourself.
I am the pastor and priest of the Church of St. Raphael the Archangel in Munster, Indiana. And last December, I was reading the newspaper and saw that Judge Mary Beth Bonaventura resigned from her position because there was a 230% increase in foster children in our system due to the opioid crisis. And the response of the governor and the Republicans in charge was to punt, to do nothing. Mm-hmm. We have the money. We have nearly $2 billion in a rainy day fund. And about the only thing that the state of Indiana is good at doing at this point is saving money. And we have got some crises in foster care. We've got problems in education. Just recently, the U.S. News and World Report downgraded us from being 27th in the nation in education to 35th in the nation. And frankly, the plight of our children in this state kept me up at night. So I flew to New York State. I asked my bishop permission to run. He said, absolutely. And so here we are. We're running for the first district. I have nothing bad to say against my opponent in the race. He has nearly half a century in politics. He's built relationships with people in the community. But my race is about the future. Mm-hmm. It's time for a new direction. It's time for us as Democrats to step forward and to take the fight to the Hoosier people and to win the battle. 1978, there were 28 Democrats and 22 Republicans in the state Senate. Today, there are 49. There are 41 Republicans and 9 Democrats. And basically what happened was that Ronald Reagan asked that famous question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And Democrats started playing on the Republican playing field. And what I want to do is I want us to go to the Hoosier people. If I'm elected to this seat, I will be willing to go out from this district, recruit candidates, and get a majority in the Senate by asking one simple question, and that is, are you better off than your parents were 40 years ago? And I think the answer is no.
Let me ask you this, since you would be representing an area that basically encompasses portions of Crown Point, but particularly the cities of Hammond and the towns of Munster and Highland and Dyer and Sherrillville and Griffith and the like. Mm-hmm. What would you say are the things that you have noted or been talking with your fellow residents about what's changed in District 1 since the last election?
Well, the biggest thing by far that they talk about is education. People are very concerned about the way that we fund education. In fact, it's a confusing situation. What they are really frustrated with is that we've got this huge surplus down in Indianapolis, but yet we still have to pass referendum to pay for our educational systems. Now, education is tied to our housing values. Housing values are tied to our incomes. It's all a string. So what I find is I find that people are really frustrated with the way that we're funding education. So I'm the only candidate who has called for an independent audit of the Department of Education down in Indianapolis. Nobody knows what they're doing. I'm calling for regular order, which is to investigate what would be the best way to fund education. We need to redo it. Our teachers need raises. They can't be the parent. They can't be the social worker. They can't be the cop, for God's sakes. So they're very concerned about that. Now, that issue, education, is really tied to the income levels that are being brought into the homes of the workers of Hammond and Munster, Dyer, Griffith, Highland, St. John, the unincorporated townships of St. John and Sherrillville. And so what I'm advocating is a new look at incentivizing unionization work in our state so that corporations that would take on union labor would receive either a tax reduction in their rate or they would receive a tax credit. Also, I'd like to do what are called introduce what are called equal presentation laws. And what an equal presentation law would be that if you want to unionize a shop to raise the pay of the workers – and the owners of the shop decide that they'd like to take company time to present against the unions, that the union would have equal presentation time to present for the unions. I'd like to get rid of right-to-work laws because that's right to work on the weekends, right to work a second shift. It's a right to work 2-3 jobs. And what we have is we have people that are stretched to the limit. those parents who want to do a good job and are trying their best to do a good job have a structural system that is rigged against them. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to see us free those people up to have one job that pays the bills so that then they can spend more time with their kids. They can come to Mass on Sunday mornings if they'd like it, particularly at my mm-hmm. church. And then they can be able to send their children to school with them fed, them be able to look over the homework like they want to look over the homework. And then the teachers then are being given a student that's ready and prepared. Mm-hmm. So education is the big thing. When I talk to them about the foster care crisis, that is huge. And we know what to do about that, and we've got the money for it. It simply wasn't done enough. And I think that what the First District needs, it's time for a new direction, because what the First District needs is a senator that will pound the desk a little bit more and go out into the state and recruit other Democrats to take back the Senate so that we can begin to start to implement these policies.
They mentioned here from the labor scene, what improvements you'd like to see made. How do you feel about, just in general, the economic development here in Northwest Indiana, and what steps should be taken that haven't been taken yet, or maybe need to go a little further?
Well, the whole philosophy of the way that we govern needs to change. We need to have a government that's of the people, by the people, and for the people. I'd like to have us shift government into a servant type of mentality. So rather than what we've been doing for all these years and trying to get the goose that lays the golden egg in terms of like big companies, I think that we should invest in the companies that are starting here, small businesses, proprietorships, partnerships. Let's give them a tax credit for hiring a part-time worker. They can $5,000 tax credit for a part-time worker if they keep them for 2 years. Or secondly, we could also have a $10,000 tax credit for full-time workers that are for full-time jobs that are open. So if the company comes in and they hire a full-time worker with benefits for 2 years, then they would get a $10,000 tax credit.
Okay. We're talking with Father Mark Murkowski, who is running for the Indiana Senate District 1 seat, and here in Northwest Indiana, and joining us in the studio along with Father Murkowski, is a current Senator Frank Mervan of Hammond. Thank you very much for being with us today, sir.
Thank you. Sorry I'm late, but we had a little traffic problem.
That's understandable too, and it's easy to get around these. In fact, we could talk about that, I guess, in a way too, but. First, if you will, give us some thoughts here about how you see the first Senate district changing here over the last few years, and certainly since the last election.
Well, since the last election, we've had quite a bit of change, especially in the first district. We had the great flood, and we had the big flood, and I was instrumental of getting $14 million for it. And then also, while it was delayed for almost a year, I went to the RDA, and after a lot of arguing, I've gotten another $6 million to last over the year so we can get the $14 million. And once this was done, I've been to every meeting here, worked like the devil, stalked the governor, and we got the money. And now when we put the Calumet River Fund to work, and it's being used now, and it's been very successful. We freed up a lot of land where there was flood insurance for people. We also a lot of economic development. Walmart is there, hotel is there, and I'm rather proud that I had such a major contribution to it. Okay. It was big, and I'm proud of it.
Okay. Father Kurowski has mentioned here about some things that he would like to see done as far as improving economic development from the labor standpoint here. What areas would you like to encourage when it's time to go back to Indianapolis next session?
Well, economic development is necessary to have a good putting people to work, and we have to do it. And the state under Governor Holcomb is going to be very cooperative, not like in the past. I have great expectations, and we've gotten a lot of money for the construction trades. Mm-hmm. They're doing quite well, and now RDA's job is to get projects that are going to hire people. They've done Marquette Park, and I think that's enough of the recreational. Now we have to get people that they have full-time jobs. And in Hammond, they've gotten the data center, mm-hmm. which is supposed to come up with approximately 100, and I helped with that. And Mayor McDermott acknowledged that I gave him a hand on getting that thing here into Hammond. And then we also have a couple other, like a trucking outfit wants to come down in an area that's rather far away from any homes. Okay. It's happening.
That's good. The next question I'd like to propose to both you gentlemen here, and way that that Father Kurowski had mentioned at first here, mm-hmm. or talking about it, is our problem with the opioid epidemic here in Northwest Indiana. Your thoughts about it, and how things are being dealt with now, and what more you would like to see done.
Well, more has to be done. We've gotten in the budget. We're going to have 9 more added opiate centers, care centers, but the thing is, in Lake County has 1, and there's 28 beds. So we're going to have to work like the devil to get some done here where we need the centers for opiate centers for treatment.
Okay, Father Mark.
And
well, one of the things I'd like to see with the opioid problem is to have us, first of all, push the Republicans to spend some of that money. They are mistaking a Category 5 hurricane for a drizzle. I think we can both agree on that where there is a huge opioid problem, they're just not addressing it fast enough or quickly enough and with enough funds. And so there's two tracks I'd like to see. First of all, I'd like to see us have an opioid set-aside court system so that we can address the opioid problem more as in a remediation. The Indiana State Constitution says that we should be treating our prisoners or those who are in violation of the law with a remediation and not retaliation or retribution. So I'd like to see us hold the Republicans accountable to that. Again, I'd like to go across the state. Let's recruit some candidates. Let's use our energy and our effort and our excitement to go out and to push them on this issue to get these opioid quote-unquote offenders, people that need help, our fellow Hoosiers, and get them into treatment programs. When you stop by and talk to folks that are in the treatment centers, they keep telling you that we are woefully underfunded, and there's also a huge stigma that is being carried with some of these issues. Again, some of the causes of the opioid crisis are the fact that even though the economy is booming, the wage level is not high enough. So we need to do things to increase the wage level of incomes of households. We're 31st in the nation for household income. So again, I go back to the unionization. It all fits together. If we can raise the incomes of the households, then we're going to solve a lot of problems or put ourselves on track to be solving a lot of problems.
Yeah. Senator Rivan?
Express it. Basically, he's saying everything that we're doing, and it's just common sense to do it. Mm-hmm. Opioids are so easily attained. That's one of the problems. We've worked on that. We are cutting back. They know and we know that it's a big problem. And we passed about 3-4 bills this session and the prior session in 2017. And getting a court system isn't what we need. What we need is medical aid, education, and stopping the people that are selling these opiates or making them available, and even the doctors are worried about that they're giving away too much. It's a gigantic problem, and we know about it, and we've been working on it for years. And as you know, nothing is done in a short while, and I'm not making any excuses. No one could do it any further, and getting a court to try people isn't going to help one bit.
We're talking with State Senator Frank Mervan of Hammond, and also his candidate on the same ballot coming up here, Father Mark Kurkowski, who is also from the Munster area, I guess. Both have been on the ballot here on May 9th. You mentioned something in particular about the problems that you run into, and you're certainly being a veteran lawmaker who dealt with this. What do you think that you and anybody that's in the seat can do to try to get the problems of being better recognized? That I'm saying Northwest Indiana being better recognized at the State House in Indianapolis, and it's pretty difficult with the way that the political makeup of the legislature is right now.
Well, I've been there a long time, as you know, and I believe a little better than 36 years. And I was there because the people approved of me, and I ran for election, and that's why I'm there. And I'm telling you, I worked as hard as I could. You know, we had a little prejudice. We do have a little prejudice there against the region. And I try to be like an angel. I did everything to make – everywhere I go, I try to promote, especially in the Senate. And they're coming along, and I've made a lot of friends, and they respect me. And that's why I should go back, because I've got the experience, I've got the respect, and they know they can trust me. And I've and I helped many of the Republicans when they were in trouble with their bills. I had to do that, because when you're in your minority, you're not going to run out on the street and start screaming, I want to collect the guns. You're going to have to talk to the people, and you're going to have to reason with them, and you may even have to beg with them. Screaming and ranting has got nothing to do in the legislature, and there's no room for that.
Brother Mark?
Well, nobody's talking about screaming and ranting. People are talking about taking a definitive stance. I think this is the clearest demarcation between Senator Mervan, whom I have a great respect, who have a great amount of respect for, and myself, is that so far he said that he has great expectations from Governor Holcomb, that that the Republicans know what they're doing, that he said that he works with the Republicans, and that's right. You do have to work with the Republicans, but what I'm seeing is that we have a 41-9 minority, and we need somebody that's going to go out and recruit new candidates to stand up and make the case that for 40 years we've been playing on this Republican playbook and on this Republican field. And here we have Senator Mervan saying that he has great expectations for the Republican governor, Governor Holcomb. And we have the Democrat Senator Frank Mervan saying that the Republicans know what they're doing, and they don't know what they're doing, and we need to have a stronger voice that's going to go out there and make the case that there is a democratic way and a democratic vision for the state of Indiana, and that's going to advance Hoosier values and Hoosier people.
Nobody in the state legislature is a bigger Democrat than me.
Well, you just said that.
Well, I know.
You just
what
said
do you want
you
me to say that he's a bum,
for...
and then next day go to him and ask him, "I need your help."
Nobody's saying
I'm
you should call
him
a bum.
I'm treating him with respect, and
I'm
they treat
you...
me with respect. Your job is to make me look bad.
No, my job is not to make you look
you're
bad.
You're trying.
I am not. I'm just stating what you
Mervan
said. You
has
just
been
said...
a Democrat all his life.
Yes, you have been, but
and
what
I...
but you seem capitulating to
no,
Governor Holcomb.
No, I'm not
Holcomb,
recapitulating. I am just being righteous is not going to get you anywhere. You have to talk to them. Nobody stood up more against the Republicans than me, and you could talk to any Republican.
But why would you come on the radio program in
Northwest
Indiana?
Because I have
Indiana
to go back to him and ask
that there
for
are
money
great
and
expectations.
And, well, no.
So we could. This is politics. So you got to call your opponents out when they need to be called.
You're
out.
My opponent, and you don't know what you're talking about. I had to have friendships. I had to have a reputation, and I work like hell to get it. And
no,
I'm telling you right now, they respect me. I'm in the minority. I work hard. I'm honest. Experienced.
That would not stop. The honesty and the hard work and a good reputation
and
integrity.
And you're not going to get anywhere by trying to destroy me.
I'm not going to try to destroy you. I'm not trying to destroy you. I have
great
respect for you.
The people reelected me I don't know how many times for 30 years. I know what I'm doing, and I'm going to keep on doing it. Hard work, honesty, experience, that's what I'm bringing to the table, and knowledge. And there are people, I know where to go and what resources we have, and I don't have to say I'm against everything. I'm the strongest Democrat that's probably in the Senate.
Nobody has said that you are.
You
not,
just said it.
No, I just said you are supposed to be holding and representing the Democratic Party, not just in the first district, but to assist other candidates throughout the state in standing up against Governor Holcomb. And you just said that you have
you
great
you
expectations
have
and that
like
the Republicans
the
know what
like
the problems
you,
are. And apparently they don't know what the problems are, because if they knew what the problems are, then we would have a solution for it. There is a Democratic vision, and I think that right now
solving,
in this race,
solving the drug
I can
problem
be the one
is
who can articulate
not a vision.
That Democratic vision.
When a man comes up to me and the governor comes up and he starts doing things, dealing with the opiates for the last 2 years, I have to encourage him and say, good, you're doing a job. And if you think you're going to go down there hating everybody,
no,
I'm a strong Democrat.
No. Nobody's saying anything
I passed
about hating
so many
anybody.
Laws that were for voting laws, et cetera. They were all pro-Democrat. And I'm not the loudest voice, but I'm the most dramatic voice, maybe that would be the word, or dedicated.
Well, gentlemen, we'll have to get you back on again here. We'll have to leave it at that.
Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
You're entirely welcome. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Chris Nolte.
For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.